1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Revcovery. This week is a very special episode. It's one that we recorded a while ago, and we've been kind of holding back and excited to share with you. As you know, we participated in Homebrewed Christianity's Theology Beer Camp in October, and we were lucky, both Justin and I, to get to interview some of the keynote speakers. And Justin interviewed Dr. Roberto Che Espinoza. And if you don't know their work, friends, I invite you to check it out. It is incredible. I asked for a bio from my friend, Dr. Roberto, and let me tell you, it does a pretty good job of explaining just sort of how broad the spectrum of the work that they've been engaged in: a scholar activist, a scholar leader, a thought leader, a teacher, a public theologian, an ethicist, a poet of moral reason, and a word artist. And all of that is true. As well as just being an incredible human, a non-binary, trans, queer, Latinx, someone who really knows how to sort of get two groups that can't really get together to understand how we can heal through our presence with each other. One of the incredible things about Dr. Roberto is the book that just came out. They wrote a book called Body Becoming, A Path to Our Liberation, and it is just a beautiful book. And so I hope that you enjoy this conversation, and more than that, I hope that you check out the work of Dr. Roberto.
My name is Justin Gentry. I'm one half of the Revcovery podcast. The other half is recording somewhere else. That's Sarah Heath. Revcovery is primarily a podcast that was originally targeted for ministers who were wondering if they were going to leave ministry. How do you do that? If you've ever been in ministry, has anyone been, who has been or is in ministry? Raise your hand. If you've ever tried to leave, it is a complex thing. Deciding to stay, deconstructing your faith, questioning your faith while you're a pastor it's a hard thing to do. Like a congregant or parishioner, like when they're questioning their faith, they come to you. When you question your faith, who do you go to? You go to the people typically that have the power to fire you. And so it becomes complex. So we want to be a podcast that tells people stories of their leaving and transitioning, people that are staying, people that are shifting in their faith, shifting in their identity, and how that plays out in ministry. And so that's going to be the kind of the focus, at least of the first half of what Dr. Roberto and I are going to be talking about today. But also it's going to open up in the middle for questions and things like that for you all. Sound good? Are we good? Excellent. So it is a distinct honor to be sitting with you and to be able to introduce you as Dr. Roberto Che Espinoza today. And what we usually do is we open this podcast up with a question of like, how long were you in? And it has kind of that feeling of like, so sentence, like, how long were you in? Or how long have you been in? And so I would just want to get a sense of your story in ministry, and also in your work now with activist theology and all the other things you do. Kind of an A to B, how did we get here with Dr. Roberto?
So, I mean, I've been in for a long time.
Yeah.
And keep trying to leave. And the church continues to somehow invite me back in.
Yeah, it's like The Godfather. Yeah. Like, they just bring me back in.
It's like Hotel California.
Yeah.
I felt, as many people did, a call to ministry at a young age. But because I didn't have the right genitalia in the Southern Baptist Church, they said, that's not possible. A year later, I had a brain aneurysm and two open craniotomies to correct that.
Oh, wow.
And they said, this is a sign. We know that you're called to ministry. And I was like, fuck you, no. and So because there was that antagonism,
yeah,
and I already knew that I was different,
yeah,
in terms of gender and sexuality, I sort of eschewed the local church and decided to go study theology as an undergrad.
Yeah.
And there I was met with lots of challenge because I was the only non-white bodied person in the classroom and the only person who was queer and trans. So it was and I was at a Baptist university where you don't talk about those things because, you know, I could have gotten kicked out of school.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I would carry around feminist theology books in the late, you know, mid to late 90s.
That is a flex. That's I like that.
And like, and because they were like my witnesses in the classroom, because I was the only sort of differently bodied person in this white space. And, you know, I was the first person in my family to finish high school, certainly the first person to go on to college, et cetera. My mom, who is from Mexico, has a sixth grade education. So, you know, I was really at a deficit in figuring out how to navigate these systems. And so I would carry around a stack of feminist theology books. And my friend Josh, who was a few years ahead of me doing his master's, people would come up to him and say, "Is that person a lesbian?" And Josh would say, why do you ask? They said, "Well, they're always carrying around feminist theology books." And Josh said, "Well, I read feminist theology. Does that make me a lesbian?" And it would just shut down the conversation because I've actually never identified as gay or lesbian.
Yeah.
I've always identified as queer. That was before queer was this umbrella term for LGBT. So fast forward, I finish my theology undergrad. I do some postgraduate work at Hardin-Simmons Logsdon School of Theology. My two white professors send me off to go study with a Latin American feminist theologian, Dr. Nancy Bedford, at Garrett Seminary, which is on the campus of Northwestern. Haven't really been out of the state of Texas. I spent my summers in Mexico, but leaving Texas was like not a thing. So I'm like fresh off the boat, no coat, no winter coat, jeans and a t-shirt, showed up for my first class in this University of Texas t-shirt, you know, like just didn't know how to navigate the space, right? I mean, there's certain scripts that you have to follow. I did an academic degree. I didn't do an MDiv because I wanted to teach.
And
this was my response to the Southern Baptist Church saying, "No, you can't do this."
Was there a little bit of like, "I'm going to stay in this out of almost like to spite you a little bit"?
So some of that, I mean, I began reading like Calvin and Luther as a high schooler. So I was already just very interested in the intellectual project of theology. And so, you know, when I got into college and was more immersed in it, I thought, "Oh yeah, I like this," but I sort of went very philosophical and, you know, was reading deconstruction before deconstruction got misused as this thing that people do with their faith.
The OG deconstruction.
And so, and, you know, was just reading a lot of, you know, Whitehead and, you know, just my professors, because I was so curious and because I could understand the discourse, my professors just kept handing me books. You know, I read a bunch on pluralism. I read a bunch on like sort of moving beyond monotheism and sort of philosophical arguments for that. And so my professor sent me to study with Nancy. And there people said, "Oh, you should be ordained." And I thought, "Well, I'm going into academia. Why should I be ordained?" "Yeah, you should be ordained. It will give you power." Well, at that time, I wasn't really attending church. And, you know, church for me was like Sunday brunch with a whole bunch of queers. And
that sounds like church to me.
And it was really life-giving. You know, it was a bunch of grad students. We could talk about what we're doing in school and what we're writing on. And so these church people said, "No, you should attend this church. They'll ordain you. And then that would give you more credibility." And I thought, seems weird. So I went to this church and I said, "So I've been told to come here that I should pursue ordination." And they said, "Well, if you go back in the closet, we'll ordain you."
Yeah.
And my partner at the time said, I'm not going back in the closet. And it just was an impossibility for me mm-hmm. at that point. And I said, well, I can't really do that. And they said, oh, okay. Well, if you don't want to go back in the closet, go to this church and you can be out and be ordained. And so I did. And it was in a north suburb of Chicago, Wilmette, very okay. rich white community. And they had an interim pastor at the time, a white gay man, mm-hmm. cisgendered man. So we started the ordination process and I would preach on occasion. I would, you know, help lead worship all while, you know, finishing my seminary degree and, you know, finished my seminary degree, wrote my thesis, and then started CPE as a discernment process of whether or not I would do the PhD.
Yeah.
And during this ordination process, this cis white gay male said to me, you have an allergy to yourself. I had always identified as queer. Mm-hmm. I'm an equal opportunity person. It doesn't matter for me, like attraction in terms of gender, that's not an issue for me.
Yeah.
It's really about the person. Mm-hmm. Do we have chemistry? Do we have connection? And so this white guy who was a PhD student at Harvard, at U of Chicago Divinity School,
okay.
said to me, you have an allergy to yourself. And he shut down the ordination process.
Oh, wow.
He said, you need more professional development and you have an allergy to yourself.
What did he, can you unpack that a little bit? Like, what did he mean by that?
I think what he meant is in some capacity, in lots of capacities, I was unintelligible to him.
Okay.
And he needed legibility in terms of gender and sexuality.
Yeah.
And intelligibility.
So it was more him saying, you don't make sense to me. Come back when you make sense and then we'll talk.
Yeah. But you know, it was a projection onto me.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And I, you know, I tried to talk to people and, you know, I tried to get advocacy and nobody would advocate for me. And, you know, internally I had, you know, sort of already reconciled my trans identity, mm-hmm. but it was not safe to come out and, you know, like, in the mid-2000s, it was still not super safe, and people expected a sort of linear transition. And I had never understood myself to be transitioning from one place to the other. Mm-hmm. I had always understood myself as a multiplicity becoming.
Yeah.
But like, there was no information about that non-binary didn't exist. And so I was really isolated and alone, and so kept it to myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said, fuck that. I left the church. No more. Ya basta. Went and did another 3 units of CPE. And there I was again, the only non-white bodied person, the only trans person, the only queer person. And every time I contributed something, it would just land in the middle and no one would respond to it. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very lonely process, a very isolating.
I'm sure.
And there was one guy who stood up for me. He was Mormon. Mm-hmm. And he would often say, you know, they have a point. But no one would engage. And, you know, I finished those 4 units. I ended up applying for PhD work because I felt like that's where I need to be. I need to study. I felt called to the vocation of theologian and left the church. Good riddance. I mean, I was on staff in several places prior to that, did a bunch of student ministry, was on the speaking circuit in Texas, you know. And at that point, I was like, no, I need to invest my time in academia and I need to figure out how do I articulate these things in a way that can do good? Because people who have power are harming people. That yes. guy who said to me I had an allergy to myself harmed me.
Yes.
And he has no idea. Mm-hmm. And I've never confronted him about it. And he sort of goes on to hold power positions and yeah. whatnot. And so I went and did the PhD and started using they, them pronouns. And
what year was this?
That was, so let's say I started in the fall of 2009.
Okay.
And, you know, sort of self-identified as trans, but not interested in like being a man, whatever man means. Mm-hmm. And, but was very interested in masculinity.
Yeah.
And something adjacent to what we understand as manhood in this context.
Yeah.
And so began working on like masculinity studies, began working on bodies, continued to read a lot of philosophy, and really just sort of abandon anything to do with theology. And was doing much more like moral philosophy, philosophical ethics, very conceptual, abstract stuff. And I met a person who was being ordained, and she wanted me to come to her ordination service. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I've done this before, whatnot.
Drag you into the church.
Right. And one of my favorite hymns is Come Thou Fount.
Yeah.
It has problematic language in it, but it's I like it.
It hits the right notes. Like some it of those hits, old hymns, like. Yeah. There's a verse in there that I wish I could remove.
Yeah. Yeah.
The parts I could keep, yeah. they hit the right notes.
And yeah. And years later, I was preaching at a church in Michigan, and they redid that with social justice words.
Oh, that's lovely.
And so it's a much better hymn in that version, which I've shared with people. But Jessica invited me to her ordination, and they were singing Come Thou Fount, so I went. An old friend of mine was preaching the service, and they both said, you know, you should be ordained. You're already doing this work. Yeah. You should be ordained. And I thought, we already tried that, and look how it turned out.
Yeah.
You know, and who's going to ordain a trans, an openly trans, like, far left, queer person, Latinx, you know, who's going to do that? And so they were like, oh, right, right. You know, it's like white people don't think about this.
Oh, we forgot.
Like white people don't think about these standpoints that marginalized people embody and occupy. And they were like, yeah, we don't know what community that would be. So, and also like not interested. Yeah. Not interested in the institutional church, not interested in ordination. And years later, I was, in 2017, got asked to be at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to go, and they're asking me to be a clergy presence. Mm-hmm. And remember, I wasn't ordained.
Yeah. I love how you don't have an interest in it, but people keep asking you.
Right. Like, and then asking me to like play these clergy roles.
Yeah.
So I had to go out and buy me a clergy shirt because they weren't having it any other way. Yeah. They're like, no, we want you to be here representing clergy.
You can get those online for really cheap.
Yeah.
Like anyone can be clergy.
I didn't have a stole. I didn't have anything.
Yeah.
So I had a friend make me a stole.
Nice.
And the kind of stole that I want. It's bright red. It's got my name embroidered on the back. And it's got a big fist on the front of it, and it says Black Lives Matter.
I like it.
You can't miss me.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'll go. I'll perform this identity.
Yeah.
Afterwards, my friend Jessica, remember Jessica, who I went to her ordination?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had now started a church, kind of a community, a ritual community, and she wanted to ordain me.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, why? But, you know, some of it made sense because I was spending so much time in the pulpit and like I'm doing this thing. I mean, I'm like a pastor to people online who have no place. And oh, so, okay, maybe this does make sense for me to do because then I can be connected to a body that would hold me accountable. So I said, okay, yeah, maybe I should do this. So I did it, and we had a very simple service of just claiming what I had already been doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm Baptist, so for me, baptism is my ordination.
Yeah.
So I don't need any sort of extra thing. But for the sake of pointing to a time and space,
yeah,
I was ordained. And so, like, I function as clergy when I need to. I only use the clergy title when I'm signing documents.
Yeah.
But I'm like a pastor to a bunch of people who like would never consider stepping in church.
Yeah.
And I think that is sacred.
Yes.
There's something important to that role.
1 Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change, it's a podcast about seeking moral high ground, and it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.
Yes.
So, still not invested in the institutional church, much prefer community and like Sunday brunch. Mm-hmm. And yet find myself being this public pastor and this public theologian and this public intellectual, all the while being on faculty at Duke Divinity School, which is like the belly of the beast. So that's how long I've been in.
Yeah.
I keep trying to leave, but they won't let me.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for being here and sharing that story. It strikes a lot of similar notes in that a lot of people's stories in ministry are like, I want in, I want out, I don't know. But you keep being drawn back into this place, even though you don't want to be here.
By people,
yeah.
Not by tradition,
yes.
Not by the institution. Yes.
And I think that people authority is very important when it comes to church spaces. I think we give institutions, we give the book of discipline, we give the thing that somebody said 200 years ago, maybe a little bit too much weight.
Right.
And giving that no, like the people aren't asking for Dr. Roberto to be here
right.
in this space.
Right.
And that makes it holy and good and mm-hmm. what is needed in this moment. And I think there's a lot of pastors that are leaving ministry because the institution is kicking them out, even though their people are saying, no, we actually still want you here. And so I love that you are able to model that being a pastor in some ways outside of an institution, mm-hmm. but still having that institutional authority.
I mean, I get messages you. All the time
yeah.
saying, are you a pastor somewhere? Like, do yeah. you convene people? And I'm like, no.
Do you convene people?
I'm not trying to do that.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, like, should I? Like, is that, like, is this question actually an invitation
yes.
to make space for people?
Yes.
Because we are meaning-making people, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we are. Yep. We are story, you know, our stories are embedded in us. But I'm not trying to have a church.
Yeah.
Like, can we call it something else?
Call it whatever you, call it brunch.
Yeah.
Like, Revcovery, we have a Discord community and a lot of people, they leave ministry and that kind of first Sunday is like, what the fuck do I do?
Yeah.
Like, so we have a brunch like Discord and where people take pictures of their brunch. Like, this is the first brunch I've had in years because I've always been a part of this. So I think brunch is a sacred and wonderful thing and yeah. we should do more of it. And so if you get nothing out of this, have more brunch
yeah.
with people that are different than you. I yeah. think that, because again, institutions sometimes do not allow for difference in a way that brunch does. So if the sacred theology of brunch may be my memoir. But I also think the posture is interesting too, because so many institutions are asked that question, why? Why would we do this? Why would we ordain this person? But I feel like the biblical tradition should be more why not? Mm-hmm. You know, with Timothy or Titus or whoever he was and the Ethiopian eunuch, I can't remember, I'm a little bit inebriated. You know, Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, like the question is like, can I be baptized? And the response is, well, why not?
Right.
Like, why not? This new thing that is happening, why not? And so I appreciate in a lot of ways you embody that energy of why not? Mm-hmm. Like, why can't I be here? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that look like me scratching their heads and getting really confused. And that to me is wrong, because we should embody that energy of why can't we do this?
Yeah.
There is nothing now in this moment and nothing that amongst the body of people that is being harmed. We're reducing harm
and posturing ourselves mm-hmm. in this way.
I find, let me also say, I went to college with a person by the name of Matt Chandler.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I don't know if that name means anything to people. And so I saw very up close ego.
Yeah.
And toxic maleness. Yeah. And platform culture. Mm-hmm. And when Matt was diagnosed with brain cancer, I reached out to him and we corresponded for a bit. And I was in my PhD program and he wanted to read my dissertation. And I thought, why? Like, you're not invested in this. In fact, you're adamantly opposed to yeah. what I'm working on. I never did let him read it. But, you know, we corresponded for a while during my program. And I just continued to watch him become much more siloed in the extreme right theology and heard stories about harm, mm-hmm. heard stories about abuse. And, you know, here is someone who, like, I knew really well in college. And I'm like, I do not want to be like that. And so I have forever sort of resisted platform culture.
Yeah.
And even now try to turn my platform into community, into relationships. And I don't see a lot of people doing that. I see a lot of people hungry for platforms. I see a lot of people who want to take up a lot of space, maybe who shouldn't have a microphone. And I see a lot of harm.
Yeah.
And no one is critically engaging platform culture in a way that is productive. I know that myself and Joe Lumen criticize it.
Yes.
But I see a lot of folks like leaving ministry, but wanting to maintain a platform. And
the pastor to life coach pipeline is,
yeah,
it's real.
And no embodied awareness about relationship. Mm-hmm. And that really concerns me. And so, you know, like as I watch my Twitter feed and Instagram feed, as I watch the followers continue, and, you know, Derek Webb and I just announced a tour that we're going to do around storytelling and music. And I see those follows and I get very nervous because what I'm fundamentally interested in is connection and togetherness. Mm-hmm. And social media does not create conditions for that. And people all the time are like, why don't you add content, like produce more content, whatnot. I'm like, I'm a scholar. I'm a theologian. I'm not a content yeah. creator.
When are you going to create a sales funnel?
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, can we not just consume this information? Can we actually live out principles that matter to us? Mm-hmm. But like, no one is interested in that.
Yeah. Because capitalism.
Right.
I think.
And because of whiteness.
Yeah. It's interesting because you talk about political theology and activist theology. And I think we need more of that. But I think there's also a lack of awareness of these systems, particularly, again, people like me, were like, this is what we live in. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the way the world works. Mm-hmm. Without asking that question, like, humans create the world that we live in.
Right.
And it doesn't have to work this way. No mm-hmm. one says it has to work this mm-hmm. way. You know, and pastors and Paul, I'll tell a quick story, and then I want to lead into maybe how politics can influence theology and theology influencing politics a little bit. So I was at a church in 2014, I believe it was, when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. And that Sunday, not to be political, the prayer that day was for the police officers that they would be safe during the race riots. Like, lots of podcast air quotes for those of you that are listening. Like, and that was the non-political way of addressing the crisis.
I would say that's a very political way of addressing crisis.
Oh, I agree. Like, again, giant podcast air quotes. And so, again, there is a water that we swim in, especially as ministers, and there is a pressure to not be political, but the pressure to not be political makes us very conservatively political in a lot of churches. And I think there are many ministers I know, and I've talked to them, that have left because they're like, hey, actually, we probably should talk about racism. But they're like, no, that's political. or, hey, we should talk about LGBTQIA inclusion. Like, no, that's political, which I'm like, y'all are the ones that politicized these bodies. Like, you're the ones that did it. Now we have to talk about it. But how would you make, what would you maybe to say to pastors that are like, I feel this need, this calling, this to address my congregation in this way that they're going to see as political. How do we begin that conversation without just the second they open their mouth, they get kicked out?
Well,
maybe that's okay. That burn it all down is an option here, but I just want to ask you the question, like, what is a way to approach that?
Well, I would say, who are we trying to be faithful to? Mm-hmm. An institution that is built on the labor, the extractive labor of darker skin bodies, or what? And how do we be faithful in the small things? Sometimes being faithful in the small things is saying the thing that no one else is willing to say. Mm-hmm. I was speaking, I keynoted an event, a Black Pentecostal event in July, Bishop Yvette Flunder's group. She is the bishop of the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries. And there I said, we are in Arizona. We are on land that is historically Aztlan, historically Mexico. And let's recall that it was Obama who deported more people than any other president.
Are you saying something bad about the Saint Obama?
Right.
Yeah.
And like, no one is willing to say that.
No
and
one
and
is.
I'm
no.
in a yep. room of like 90% Black folk.
Yeah.
And I kept going. And I yes. said,
keep going.
And if we care about our LGBTQIA siblings, mm-hmm. then we need to do something about Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm. He's going to undermine his own marriage.
Yes.
Because if we think Roe v. Wade is the end of things, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's going to go to Obergefell.
Yes.
And then it's going to go to Loving versus Virginia and Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. They're undoing it all. And Bishop Yvette Flunder said, you see, we have a prophet. I don't consider myself a prophet. I'm quoting her. See, we have a prophet who is willing to say what no one else is willing to say.
Yep.
You know that you're all thinking this.
Yep.
And I think we need, I'm risk adverse, number one. So I don't gamble, you know, I don't get drunk. But I do risk in telling the truth.
Yes. Okay.
And I think we need to become a little bit riskier when it comes to truth telling.
Yes.
And so, you know, for the pastor who feels this nudge or this urge to not go with the party line, can you imagine being faithful in telling the truth? I mean, the old adage is true. The truth will set us free.
Yeah.
What truth and whose truth, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I think politics is essentially how we organize land, how we organize people, and how we organize power. And to me, I don't see how that cannot be theological in the way that it works. Like, your theology, the what you believe about God, what you believe about people, is going to impact that. So I think an encouragement to pastors is to understanding you are doing politics while you are doing theology.
Right.
They're not, you know, systematic theologians like to think that they're above the fray. But like, a theology must always trickle down to how we arrange bodies, how we arrange power, how we arrange the space that we are in.
Right.
And I think asking ourselves who is not included here
right.
is a theological and a political question.
Well, the Greek term polis, from which we get politica, mm-hmm. is organizing bodies.
Yeah.
And so if we are not thinking about the systems that organize bodies, mm-hmm. look at how we organize bodies into a binary. Look at yes. how we organize bodies into a racial category. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to check two boxes, white and then of Hispanic heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So Latino people, you know, get lumped into this white category, mm-hmm. which I think screws the algorithm. But yeah. but that's an example of like how we organize bodies.
Yeah. Like, the questions we ask on those forms is political, and
right.
it is, and it has roots in a lot of
right.
bad theology
right.
as well.
Right.
So yeah, I think this is an ongoing conversation that I think, and that pastors have to ask themselves, what am I willing to risk my job? Am I willing to risk my pension? Am I willing to risk for these people that I'm called to serve?
I mean, I will say that two things. So many pastors served the all-American dollar. Mm-hmm. So much so that they are deeply compromised.
Yes.
And just having a platform doesn't mean your fridge is full or your rent is paid.
Yes.
So I'm saying a lot of things out there that is undermining like normative scripts. But that doesn't mean that I always have a living wage or, mm-hmm. you know, always am able to like buy my groceries or pay my rent. Mm-hmm. But I am willing to speak the truth and use words whenever necessary mm-hmm. because it matters, because my people, not just Latino people, but queer people and trans people, we are being disposed of mm-hmm. by the very politics that these institutional churches uphold.
I want to open it up to questions from the audience. If you have any questions, if you have questions related to like RevCovery type stuff or what we just talked about, great. If you have a question that's like completely not related to that at all and you just want to ask, that's fine too. Like there's not like an agenda here for as far as your questions go. So if you have any questions, speak loudly and I will interpret your question for the audio, and then maybe badly, maybe well, you can grade me, and then we'll have Dr. Roberto answer. Yeah. Yeah. I'll just kind of repeat it a little bit. The question was, you know, we have this debate between, you know, kind of the knowledge that we have versus the things that we do, the practical and the accumulation of knowledge. And I think centering your work on like, hey, this is the pragmatic thing that we do today. But how do we get people to doing that? You know, is it just, you know, again, 20 years of knowledge and then finally, oh, aha, I get it. Or is it too late and we need to just drag folks kicking and screaming into the new paradigm?
So there are three sites of supremacy that I talk about: medicine, religion, and education. And each of those sites demand a passive epistemology, meaning when you go to the doctor, you describe what's going on, and then you receive the knowledge. And you can either take the medicine or not. In education, you go through school because it's compulsory, and you sit at a desk and you receive and you accumulate knowledge. And then, you know, like if you are a good citizen, you'll go to college, you'll get some sort of technical degree, and you'll become a good citizen by getting a job. For religion, same thing. You go into a building, you sit in a pew, you receive a message, and you internalize with no expectation to live it out. These are all three folds of supremacy culture. My question to that in both of my books, so my first book is really saying we need to free theology from academia, from the ivory tower, and put it into the hands of people, meaning we need to encourage common people to have agency to think for themselves and to learn how to be in community and create knowledge production in community and not just passively receive and do nothing with it. In my second book, I talk about how embodiment is a vision for democracy, that we can literally save our democracy by learning to have a relationship with our bodies, because when I have a better relationship with my body, I am better in relationship with you. And that affects our praxis. So I'm not saying do away with education. I'm saying we need to do it better. We need to do it in a non-supremacist way. I was talking to Nathan about this. I still believe, and it's how I run my classes at Duke, I still believe that things like theology and philosophy can, it for back of letter, for lack of better wording, shapes our souls. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten far away from that. And so the way I lead my classes at Duke is conversation. And I say, you have to read and think for yourself, because I'm just here to facilitate a conversation. And yet students who, whatever age, they go to seminary, they go to college, and they expect to receive some sort of divine wisdom so that they can just like meditate on it. But we have to remember that theology is both contemplation and action for the sake of what? Justice.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah. The question was, how are we, you know, when we look at masculinity, a lot of times we associate it with toxic masculinity. And so when we see God, we should be seeing God as feminine, but also how do we see God in a healthy masculine way?
So I'm very excited to meet you because one of my next projects is on ethical masculinities. And
excellent.
And so I'm trying to figure out how to do a class on ethical masculinities because so much of my resistance to like going on testosterone was I was not interested in becoming a man, whatever man means. I'm interested in masculinity. And so, you know, now I call myself a non-binary trans guy. You know, the father language for God has never bothered me, but I understand why it bothers people. The mother language has never appealed to me, but I understand why it's important to people. And so, you know, my curiosity is similar to yours. Like, how do we create conditions for ethical masculinities to emerge? Because there's a lot of trans guys out there who have not addressed the internalized misogyny and live out this toxic patriarchy that is harming people. And they learn it from religion, from education, and from medicine, because each of those sites are deeply misogynistic and highly patriarchal. So I'm working on something, which I mean, I could talk a little bit about, like, I'm working on some stuff around tenderness. I'm working on some stuff around generativity, that masculinity should be both tender and generative and rooted, a sense of rootedness in your body. I mean, there's a lot of trans folks who are disconnected from their body for lots of reasons. Then there's a lot of cis people who are disconnected from their bodies. So yeah, one of my next projects is on ethical masculinities, and Tripp and I are thinking about doing like some men's work together, kind of like a men's retreat on, because like here we are not talking about race or the fact that the majority of people here are white-bodied people. Like, where is the race analysis? Where's the class analysis? Because race and class are connected. Where's the gender, sex, and sexuality analysis? What about the analysis around ability? Like, the intersectional piece is not here. So how do we recover that? And how do we steward the logic of liberation even in our masculinities? So it's forthcoming.
Anything else? We still have time. Yeah, yeah. The question was, if someone who's out of church for a while coming back in because you want to contribute in some way and getting involved in the institution of church, how do you get involved in that institution in a way that is helpful and beneficial, that without getting caught up in it and all of a sudden like, hey, I'm back defending an institution again, but also isn't working? Sometimes you can work against the institution within it, and then you're frustrated, they're frustrated, everyone's frustrated. So how? Yeah, and then you're kind of back in, do I stay or go? So how do you wrestle on that tension?
So, yes, I may teach at Duke, which is an elite R1 school. I am very much a fugitive who is in exile because my project is unintelligible to the academy. And I am not invested in systems that are death-bringing, which I would say the institutional church is, and all these other sites of supremacy. I think the only way forward is abolition. And by that, I mean life-affirming systems. I don't think electoral politics is a life-affirming system. Neither Democrat nor Republican is a party that is stewarding liberation. Establishment politics is not going to get us anywhere. Establishment church politics is not going to get us anywhere. So this may not be the answer that you want, but if you are invested in systems that are creating conditions for liberation, great. But if they are systems that are stewarding the same bullshit and maintaining the status quo, they may be doing more harm than good. They may make people feel good, but charity is not going to save us. And charity is not liberation.
Any other questions? I think you've shut down a room of homebrew Christianity folks. So I do want to ask one last question for the pastor that maybe is listening to this, or, you know, we have a lot of super volunteers that listen to our podcast too, that are like, you know, they've, they probably should be paid for their work, but they aren't, unfortunately. So that person that is feeling that nudge or is starting to look downstream and realizing my church is not producing results that are good, or my church is not, for to use a biblical metaphor, I mean, we are encouraged in scripture to measure the fruit of a teaching, to test the spirits. And they're beginning to test the spirits of the institution that they've become involved in. And they're like, it is a bit rotten. What is maybe something a bit rotten being? I just saw like a couple people raise their eyebrows, like a bit, Justin, that's putting it mildly. You find yourself, if you find yourself in that and you begin to start, I hate to use the term waking up, but you begin to become more aware of the harm that is being done around you. What are some practical steps to begin extracting yourself or begin making some change there?
I mean, I think that what you just said is spot on. Mm-hmm. We can tell a lot by what fruit is being produced.
Yeah.
I don't know that we're paying attention, though.
True.
To what fruit is being produced. Many of us are so tethered to these systems that we can't see straight. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember good is a contested term. What is good for me is not necessarily what's good for you. Mm-hmm. And so we need to have an analysis around what is good fruit and for whom and to what end. And, you know, I, in many respects, think we need to be organizing around abolitionist frameworks. I think that, you know, Dorothy Soleil in the 60s began holding Evensong where they had conversations about pressing social concerns and then acted on that. Mm-hmm. And that was their form of worship. And that is good theology.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that we need to develop an analysis. And if you don't know how to do that, we do that on our podcast every week, the Activist Theology Podcast. Yeah. So you could check out some of those episodes. So develop an analysis, have a critical reflection about where you are, and then figure out what you will do in response to that knowledge, to that reflection, and to that analysis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. If you have any questions that you were like, I don't want to ask this publicly, I want to ask this privately, you're going to stick around, right?
Yeah.
So thank you very much. Let's go ahead and just give Dr. Roberto a round of applause. So
thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you are enjoying the conversations you hear on RevCovery, you can continue the conversation with us and many more incredible people in the RevCovery room on Discord. To access our Discord, please join our Patreon to become part of the RevCovery room community. You can join for as little as $4 a month, and this helps us produce the show, as well as gives you access to the community resources. Check it out at www.patreon.com/RevCovery. We know that not everyone is able to financially support the show, but there are lots of ways to support us, including giving us a 5-star review wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to like and subscribe across all social media. RevCovery Room is our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook handle, so you can find us there to keep the conversation going. Now on to some final thoughts and this week's poem.
Friends, thanks again for sticking around for another episode of RevCovery, and I hope that you enjoyed the conversation. I wanted to actually quote, I've never done this before, quote the guest themselves. This is from Dr. Roberto's book, Body Becoming, and it is this simple statement. Oppression is unprocessed trauma on a collective scale. I found that to be such a profound quote. And then I got an email from Dr. Roberto, and that's part of their signature. And so I thought it would be a fitting way for us to end this week's RevCovery. Thanks again for joining us.
First Corinthians warned you about the women with a loud mouth, and this podcast is just that. Here at the Speaking in Church podcast, we talk all about the regular people and the things that regularly happen to them in the evangelical church. It's a podcast about change. It's a podcast about seeking moral high ground. And it's a podcast for people who are just trying to deconstruct on the safe side. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a guest, yes, you, regular person, you can be a guest on the Speaking in Church podcast. If you want to come on, just let us know.